All right, let's do this. How are you, what the fuckers, what the fuck buddies, what the fuck nicks, what's happening? I'm Mark Maron. This is my podcast, WTF. Welcome to it. I imagine most of you have been here before. You've hung out a bit. You know what's happening. You know who I am. You know what the deal is. You know whether or not I annoy you, or whether or not you like me, or whether or not I annoy you and you like me. You know these things. It's been a long time now that we've been hanging out. You and I and that guy. It's been a while that we've all been here together, us and those two over there. It's been, well over a decade, maybe 13 years almost, since we've all been just sitting around talking, and those guys over there and that lady. All of us. Don't alienate them just because they're weird. We're all fucking weirdos. Some people are toxic weirdos, though. I'd say the self-aware weirdos are where we're at. I think that's where we need to be. Self-aware weirdos, not toxic weirdos. Evil weirdos. You don't want to be an evil weirdo, do you? Do you? Today on the show, I talked to Jen Statsky. She is the co-creator and showrunner and writer of the show Hacks on HBO. She used to write for Parks and Rec, The Good Place, Broad City, Lady Dynamite, Late Night with Jimmy Fallon. She's a writer. She comes from the Boston area. So that Jen's going to be here. It's a nice conversation, heavy. I'll tease it a little bit from here. Only child. And, you know, I get a little curious about only children. But besides that, tomorrow night, I'll be in Durham, North Carolina at the Carolina Theater, then Charlotte, North Carolina on Saturday at the Knight Theater. And on Sunday, I am in Charleston, South Carolina at the Charleston Music Hall. Go to WTFpod.com/tour for all dates and ticket info. I am exhausted. It's weird because I was walking with Kevin Nealon, and I'll be honest with you. I don't want to tip it, but I did Kevin Nealon's hikey show. I don't even know if he was able to get what we needed. He'd been bothering me about this for months to do the hike show where we walk, and he's got a camera on a thing, on a selfie stick, and we do a little interview and we hike outdoors. So I had him come over on to this side of the place. We go up to the hike up here, and it's midday because he had to do something with his kid, and you know, it was hot. We were sweating. He'd forgotten the batteries that he had charged for the camera. We didn't know if that was going to hold up. He's got a drone. I've never worked with a drone before. It's very exciting. Exciting in the way that, like, what am I, seven? Can I play with it? Can I control it? I didn't say that, but that was going on inside of me. It's kind of exciting to see the drone, but he was he's a one man show. This Nealon guy with the camera and the drone, and we're doing stuff and we're talking. And it was nice. It was good to see him. He's a funny guy. It was funny to see him wrestling with a drone and dealing with the aggravation of being his own production team. That was funny. I don't know that he would see it that way. I found it to be amusing. He kept saying, thank you for being patient. And I kept thinking, no, this is the funniest thing I've seen in months. But he said, you know, what is the most exciting thing you've done in your life? And, you know, it's like there's so many exciting things. And and it's sort of a day-to-day thing. I've had some great accomplishments. But, like, to be honest with you, day before yesterday or 2 days ago, I watched some of an Altman movie with Kit. And then there was some really connected, good sex. And then after that, it was like, let's walk to Baskin and Robbins and have an ice cream cone. And that was like the best ice cream cone I can remember having in my adult life. Is that weird? And the sex was good too. The movie, not great. It was Buffalo Bill and the Indians, and we didn't get far into it. It was okay, but I think it requires some patience we didn't have. But that ice cream cone, it was just a chocolate-dipped waffle cone with a scoop of vanilla and a scoop of gold medal, whatever that is. And I don't go, who goes to Baskin Robbins that often? But the weird thing is, I'm of a certain age when I remember when Baskin Robbins was the ice cream place. That was it. That was like, we're going to go to get ice cream out at Baskin Robbins. I think if you're on the East Coast, you had a Friendly's here and there. But where I lived, Baskin Robbins, and it's lit the same way and it's set up the same way. And right when you walk in, and it smells the same. There's that journey back. And the woman who was there was giving me these scoops that were monstrous. like I was watching her scoop and I had a moment where I was like, yeah, I think that's it. But I stifled that immediately. I was like, all right, that's what you're going to do. We're going to go, we're going to do it. And I'll eat fucking all of that. But it was just that kind of sex ice cream combo. I mean, that's all you got for me. I'm not a drug person. So you're dealing with caffeine. You're dealing with endorphins released during sex, and you're dealing with sugar. And that was just, you know, they were all going, and it was magical. This is not an ad for Baskin Robbins. So look, I'm experimenting. I have this list I wrote down on a piece of paper. It just says trauma, tolerance, empathy. Interesting list, I know. I could explain it more, but I've been experimenting with being empathetic for the worst of us. With the worst of us, because some of the worst of us, some of the broken-minded grievance and blame junkies who are moving this country more towards something that no longer resembles a democracy. I'm not being political here. I'm just saying I'm trying to be empathetic because, like, it'd be hard for me to be totally empathetic with someone who grew up in India because I don't know what that experience is. But I grew up with these fucking fascists. They were my neighbors. They're the kids I knew in school. We're all of the same. But and I understand the thinking. I want to believe things. I make connections of things that happened to me in almost a conspiratorial, mystical way. But I know myself. I am self-aware of the way my brain works and how it's broken and whether and when I have to say no to my mind. Sometimes my mind does things and I'm like, no, we're not doing that. Nope, you stop it right now, mind. You stop it right now. We won't have any of that shit. That goes nowhere good, brain. Nowhere good. But I get it. Look, man, I've been having some shit go down over here. There's some signs. There's some moments. There's some indicators. If I want to look at them like that, right? I mean, you guys know, I had a coyote in the yard the other day, hanging out, just sleeping, looking at me. What's a coyote mean? What does it mean? Look it up. What does a coyote mean? Spiritual, mystical, Native American. Could mean good, could mean bad, could mean, you know, something is going to happen that you don't expect at all. Could mean a lot of things. All those things could happen also without the coyote. But let's just assume that the coyote is an indicator. Then a couple days, maybe the next day, I thought the coyote ate the rabbit. The rabbit had not been eaten. The rabbit was just sitting there on my stoop. The rabbit. So there's a coyote visitation. There's a rabbit visitation. All right? Do you understand what's happening? It's all happening. These, you know, what does that mean? What does the rabbit mean? Why do they too? Why is there so many birds around? What's with the bird nests? Why? What are they trying to communicate? Why is my house surrounded by electric wildlife? And then I went on a hike the other day and I got stung by a fucking bee. I got stung by a bee. What is that about? I can't even remember the last time I got stung by a bee. It's kind of like the Baskin Robbins thing. It happens when you're a little kid. It's very consistent, but I wasn't allergic. I didn't start choking or breaking out in hives, but I got stung by a bee and I knew it was a bee. And I reached around my back and I felt it and I grabbed the bee and then I saw it crawling on my leg with a big kind of string of ooze from its ass because, you know, it done its duty. It done its job. It made its kamikaze mission on my back to no end. It meant nothing, right? What a waste of a stinger. Here's the point. What does it mean? Coyote plus rabbit plus bird plus, you know, getting stung by a bee. How does it all come together? Well, I know the answer isn't the Jews are in on it. Okay? That's what I'm saying. Had nothing to do with the Jews. I'm a Jew. Maybe I'm being targeted somehow. But see, even that's a fucking stretch. The point is, if you're going to string together a bunch of random things, even if they seem like they sound like they make sense and they could be connected, it's just an attempt to have a context, to have an explanation, to have some sort of chain of events that explains things, but may be completely disparate and have nothing to do with each other. And also could be complete bullshit. And the Jews had nothing to do with it. That's all I'm telling you. Like maybe some Native American spirits for me, but I mean, rethink it. No brain, no, those aren't connected things. They have no meaning whatsoever. Hey, brain, I just put a bunch of bullshit into your engine. Disregard. disregard the bee sting, the coyote, the rabbit, the birds. All right? The Jews will not replace me because I'm a Jew. Right? That's what the bee said to me. Look, hey, listen. It was great talking to Jen Statsky. It was because I don't talk to a lot of writers specifically about writing and where they come from. And yeah, it was good. And it was enjoyable. And I liked the show. It's weird because as a comic, you don't know if you're going to like a show about comics because usually you don't. But they were very specific about how about the life of this particular comic and the backstory. And it was, I think, on the money. And remains on the money in a lot of ways. As a comic, I'm not thinking like, this is bullshit. So anyways, season two of Hacks just finished. You can watch both seasons on HBO Max. This is me talking to the co-creator of that show, Jen Statsky. Every now and then, there's a decision that's a no-brainer. And I can tell you from experience, it was a no-brainer to use Stamps.com when we started using it 11 years ago. Crazy. 11 years ago. Now, more than a decade later, Stamps.com is better than ever. The Stamps.com mobile app is like having a post office in your pocket wherever you are. You can take care of things on the go, like mailing checks, sending invoices, legal documents, and more. Easily schedule package pickups through your Stamps.com dashboard. And when you need to take care of shipping, all you need is a computer and printer. Stamps.com even sends you a free scale. Make the same no-brainer decision that over 1 million other businesses have with Stamps.com. Sign up with the promo code WTF for a special offer that includes a 4-week trial plus free postage and a free digital scale. No long-term commitments or contracts. Just go to Stamps.com, click on the microphone at the top of the page, and enter code WTF. Like Los Angeles?
I do. I mean, like, I'm used to it, you know?
Yeah.
I'm an East Coaster, and I do.
Where? From?
Right outside Boston.
Where?
Milton.
I went to school in Milton.
You did?
Curry College.
You went to Curry College?
For a year.
No way.
I did. I went to Curry College for a year.
I was my summer camp where I worked was at Curry College.
What kind of summer camp?
It was a YMCA day camp where I was a counselor, and that we used the grounds of Curry.
No kidding.
That's so funny that you went to Curry.
I was there. Yeah, I was there for I kind of blew it in high school, and I scrambled my senior year. Yeah. I decided I got to go somewhere. And I ended up at Curry. And I have memories of it pretty good. I mean, it was okay. I don't remember learning anything, but I remember.
You went to BU though, right? Did a year there.
I went to Curry for a year and then I did four more at BU.
Yeah, the 5-year program.
Yeah, I did the 5-year program. Why take that last year kind of easy? But Milton, that's pretty fancy.
You know,
isn't it?
It is fancy. There's a very fancy private school there, Milton Academy.
Right.
Which I drove through the grounds on my way to public school. I did not go to Milton Academy. I went to public school in Milton. But Milton is a weird, there's half of the town that is like super fancy,
right,
super wealthy.
Yeah.
And then there's another half that is not really. I mean, I haven't lived there in
a long time.
A long time. But that's
I was probably
was
in
like
school there before you were born.
I
was there 81, 82. That's when I was in Milton.
Okay. I was born in 85.
Okay. So I just missed you.
Just missed each other. Would have been fun. Would have been fun to hang.
But then it was all like it was like a few miles away from Mattapan, right? Didn't you just
yeah,
drive?
Yeah, very close to Mattapan, yeah.
I just don't, I kind of, I just remember it was a big deal to like, it wasn't, you had this idea that I'm going to school in Boston,
mm-hmm,
but it was a schlep.
Yeah.
It's not like you just go to Boston.
No.
It was far.
Public transportation was not great.
And out to Milton?
Yeah. It wasn't an easy thing to just, even though Milton is 15-minute drive into Boston, as a kid, the public transportation was not great. So like I didn't get to go into Boston a ton. I did because my dad is from Southie and is very—
Really?
Yeah. So we would—
What's his story?
He was a—
From
is,
Southie?
He still is. He's alive. From Southie.
Irish guy?
No, Polish. Polish Catholic.
Huh.
And
that was happening in Southie?
Yeah, there's like a small Polish population in Southie. Yeah. But yeah, he born and raised in Southie. His parents own like a corner store. Very, very working class. Like, didn't finish high school.
Yeah.
Became a building inspector for the city of Boston.
Your dad did?
Yeah.
Did he talk like he was from Southie?
He has a crazy thick accent. Like, so thick that when I moved into NYU my freshman year, the roommate who I was assigned to couldn't understand him.
Really?
Yeah. He came in and she had a photo that she had put up of her and her boyfriend, I guess, at the time. And he was like, ah, is that your hugga? Is that your hugga? And she looked at him and I was like, he's saying, is that your hugger? Which is like, you know, it's like Southie. They have all these like weird terminology.
Boston slang is the weirdest.
It's really weird, but he's so that.
Like there's like Jimmy's. For your ice cream.
Yeah, which is not, which apparently is a racist term. That
is it really?
Yeah.
I had no idea. Not,
but that's Boston for you. There's so much stuff we grew up with.
And there was some other one. There was some other one that was weird for soda. Or I can't remember. It's like the fighter. So your dad was in.
It's like, all those cliche Boston movies I watch and I'm like, this is exactly correct.
They get it right?
Yeah, they do. They really do get it.
Do you judge the actors who do Boston accents pretty harsh? It's a tough one.
It's a tough one.
I would turn down a role if I was expected to do that.
Yeah. Do you think, how is your Boston accent?
I could probably do it. I can't drop right into it, but I'd have to think about it.
Yeah.
Yeah. I mean, I spent a bit of time there.
Yeah, I don't judge it too harshly, but it does very much stick out to me when there's a
sort
bad
of annoying.
One.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Yeah. I was there for a long time. I was in Somerville and it definitely had a profound impact on me. I grew to resent New England townies fairly deeply.
Well, that's kind of my experience too, is that even though I'm from there and I do have some, you know, real affection, some of my best friends still live there.
Sure.
And the thing about it, the chip on the shoulder is a very real thing for people in Boston. I don't exactly know why, but I felt that very strongly, like, you know.
They just have it.
They just have it. I don't know what it is.
I wonder if it's an Irish thing.
It might be, because
It's just some sort of extension of the general historical chip on the Irish shoulder.
Yeah.
It's just sort of the American version of it.
It might be. That's true. Yeah, because Milton, where I grew up, had the highest per capita Irish Catholic population in America.
I thought you say chip on the shoulders. The highest per capita.
Yeah, they did a study and the highest per capita chips on shoulders.
Oh, so it was Irish mostly?
Super Irish. Super Irish Catholic, yeah.
It's so odd that I had this, I started doing comedy there and I spent a lot of time there and I began, I got kind of afraid of them.
Yeah.
Of like, you know, the Boston Irish. Because they were intense and it was scary. And it was weird because the first time I went to Ireland, I saw a lot of Irish people that looked much like the Irish in Boston. So I was naturally kind of nervous.
PTSD,
But they're also sweet there.
Yeah, they're very, as I've been to Ireland, they're the sweetest people.
But they look the same as the ones in Boston, don't they?
Yeah, for sure, for sure.
It freaked me out.
But it's a love-hate thing for me because the chip on the shoulder bothers me. But then at the same time, there's a toughness there that I genuinely love and
connect
with. Oh, yeah,
and they're characters, too.
Yeah,
like,
yeah.
Your dad sounds like one of those characters.
He's an absolute character,
They're not hiding much. I mean, they're not, they're very forward facing.
Yes. Yeah.
What about your mom? Is she from there?
So my mom was from High Park. Do you know High Park?
Yeah.
It's like, so she kind of, I mean, my mom was, she passed away a few years ago.
Sorry.
Oh, thanks.
Yeah.
Pretty mentally ill, to be honest.
Oh,
like,
really?
Yeah. Her and my dad had a very, not ideal relationship, though married to the day she died.
No kidding. What do you mean mentally ill? Like what kind?
She as I got older, she kind of, it was kind of an agoraphobia.
Yeah.
It was
really?
Kind of like a not leaving the house.
Oh, so the family didn't quite identify it as mentally ill until retrospect?
No. I'm identifying it, but I'm the only one.
Oh, right. Oh, okay. Yeah.
Because my dad, you know, again, a character, but there is no discussion of feelings or
emotional language other than excitement and anger.
Exactly. So it's, and I'm an only child. So it's like that funny that I'm the only one living in reality some degree.
Oh, and so your mom was just a little freaked out.
Yeah, she was just there was definitely undiagnosed bipolar or
my God.
Something going on where it was, it was just not.
Wow.
Not so the best.
And you're the only one. You were the only child.
I'm the only child,
And you had to get out. Because it's so weird. I was watching that. I finally got around to watching some of that George Carlin doc last night.
I haven't watched it yet.
Well, there's just some, like, he's Irish New York, you know? And there's something about that capacity to stuff feelings.
Yeah.
That seems to be a Catholic thing. Certainly an Irish Catholic thing. I don't want to generalize, but
no,
you know,
it's super.
And he was highly aware of it and still couldn't do anything about it.
Yeah, it's very, you know, the being taught the language of feelings and how to talk about these things is very, it's very rare. And it's only a recent thing, I think. And so, yeah, I mean, I don't know.
How are you at it?
I've had to get good at it because I had to. It was such a kind of fraught 0 through 18, you know, that once I left, I was like, oh, I really...
You were not socialized?
I was like, oh, I need therapy pretty bad.
A feral Catholic, like from just being in the house. You didn't know how to...
Yeah, I had to be socialized, put in a pen with other animals to socialize.
Other emoting people.
Yeah.
And I don't know, like, just talking about it, I'm not sure how good I am at communicating it. I think I'm like, I'm okay. Good. But there are people I talk to. I mean, you only need a couple, right? You can't just run around emoting all the time.
No, that wouldn't be good either. No. Yeah.
My brother's like that, where you're just sort of like, dude, just keep some of it in.
Talking to the waitress. Yeah.
Just too much. Like, well, my dad was terrible. What are the specials? Yeah. That's my brother. So you were just there in the house. You needed to get out, I imagine.
Yeah, I was very, you know, my dad worked a lot. He was a building inspector, like I said, but he also was a bartender and just like, I think, you know.
Did he work at a bar called Patty's?
He worked at Amryan's.
Okay.
Amryan's in South Boston, if anyone's listening.
He stayed in there. He lived in Milton.
That's the thing is that we lived in Milton. Yeah. They moved there, and I think probably because the schools were better and stuff. But like, he never left behind that Southie boy thing,
So he knew the Bulger brothers and grew up with all that shit.
Yeah, he grew up with all that. Ugh. He like a couple of...
Did you watch Black Mass?
That's a good question. I got to ask him. Like a couple of years ago, this was so bizarre. I still don't understand how it happened. Like a Postmate came to my door. Yeah. I ordered food, and my husband was like, "Hey, Jen, the Postmate wants to talk to you." And I was like, "Wants to talk to me? Well, he's got questions about the order. What are we talking about?" And it was this guy that my dad had. Like, I guess, you know, my dad spent a lot of time around the projects in Southie, and he was kind of like this surrogate father figure, I guess, to guys there. And this guy who actually was part of Mark Wahlberg's like entourage, he's sort of the group of guys that Entourage then was based on, was telling me that my dad used to like come and pick them all up in his truck, and he was like, yeah, these guys didn't have shoes, and your dad took us to buy sneakers, and I'm just like, thank you for my food. And I still That happened in LA, and I don't know. And it's that really interesting thing, right? Of like, he wasn't super present for me in the ways I wish he had been. Yet I'm hearing about this whole other
right world. The street thing.
I think the pull of that was hard for him to shake.
Yeah, and I get there's an understanding. I mean, he must have been. I don't know. Maybe he was just baffled by a daughter.
I think he was baffled by my mom and how to like maybe handle that, and then probably baffled by a daughter and baffled by the idea of marriage, and you know, it didn't seem like he got it or wanted to get it.
It just all happened.
It happened.
And then he'd go back to Southie and work.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah, and he just felt...
I had a second life out in the suburbs.
Yeah. For years, I was like, do I have a sister or brother? I don't know. Maybe I still do.
But, is he still around, your dad?
Yeah, he's still around.
And you guys get on all right?
We get on all right.
Yeah.
Yeah. There's, you know.
Yeah, I do. Yeah. You know, you go through periods.
Yeah.
And then they get really old if you're lucky. And then you kind of got to go suck it up and deal with them.
Yeah. Exactly. Kinda,
yeah.
But I just, so growing up, you know, it was a lot of me alone watching TV. Honestly.
So you did that? Were you, so you're kind of the latchkey, watched a comedy person?
Watched a lot of TV. Also just like leaned, I think the lack of kind of structure that way made me lean super hard into like achievement and school, like, and just became like hyper focused on that stuff.
Oh yeah, but yeah. Were you like a comedy person?
Yeah, I wasn't doing comedy.
No, but
I,
when you were a kid, were you watching it?
I loved it. Yeah, oh, yeah. I was watching like Nick at Night, Mary Tyler Moore Show was like my thing.
Really, that was the thing.
I was obsessed. Yeah, I was that was a huge influence on me. So oh, yeah. I was watching a ton of comedy. And then when I got to New York, when I went to NYU, I started discovering more like watching stand-ups I loved and watching, you know, doing UCB and stuff.
So when you graduate, you went to high school and you didn't do anything there? You didn't do any performing?
I didn't do any performing or comedy there. I like wrote, I was an editor for like the school newspaper and I like wrote.
Breaking the big stories?
Yeah. Kind of the Woodward and Bernstein of Milton High School. No, I was doing like looking back, they were humor columns.
Yeah.
I'm using quotes around humor.
But so you did, but looking back, like you don't remember in the moment writing things that were supposed to be funny?
I don't think so, no. Like, is that weird? Like, I don't think I knew at the time that I liked comedy or that I was trying to do comedy.
That was your angle?
Yeah, exactly.
Yeah.
But yeah, that was kind of what I wrote for the paper, things like that. That was the closest I got to any sort of comedy in high school.
And you, like you've created this picture for me that, do you had friends and stuff, yeah?
Yeah.
Okay.
Yeah.
Like the home life seemed a little dark.
The home life is a little dark. I had wonderful best friends who were really like surrogate family to me, who are still, you know, some of my closest friends. They're still my best friends.
Oh, yeah?
But yeah, it was an interesting kind of, there was this like home life thing happening and there were, no one really got what was going on with it. And it was a very like, I think I also used humor in that way.
Sure.
Very common thing kids do of like, no, pay attention to this. I'll be funny or I'll do this as to distract from what's going on.
Were you afraid to bring people home?
Yes. I wasn't allowed to bring people home.
By who?
By my mom.
Oh.
Yeah.
Was that a germ thing or part of the agoraphobia?
She was so hyper. It was agoraphobia, but she was so hyper focused on appearances.
Yeah.
She was a big part of how her agoraphobia developed over the years was she was super, she would spend hours like putting on makeup and like caring a lot about appearance. And so it was very tied to like, oh, the house, it's about how the house looks and things have to look
so
right.
It sounds like OCD too, huh?
I think some OCD, yeah.
Wow.
Yeah. So it was very. But then there was also, you know, my parents got into fights where like the cops would come. And so
it was no booze, just weirdness.
There was booze. Yeah. Yeah. And so that was also part of it.
The neighbors would call.
Exactly. Yeah. That's the worst. And then, you know, your neighbors who are kids at school with you. And so it was kind of, it created this need in me to deflect, you know, go like, no, look at me being funny or look at me doing well in school. Look at me doing sports, something like that.
Just kind of get into the control your life mode.
Exactly.
Chaos.
Yeah. Chaos. Yeah. Chaos, I think. Kind of from talking to people who grew up in similar things, like you either go towards more chaos
or you go hyper opposite control.
And I went very much so
it's
towards
like booze.
Control.
Guys, you know, people grew up in boozy, crazy homes.
Yeah.
Either they go boozy or they
exactly.
Never touch the shit.
Right, exactly.
Well, whatever, whatever, something picked the right one. you got lucky. Who knows how that can go.
Yeah, it's a more inward turmoil, I think, the control route.
I guess that's true. I guess if you don't need the attention, you know, or you don't seek it in that way of like, oh, I'm crazy.
Right.
So you got into NYU?
I really wanted to go to New York. My dad had taken me to New York and we had spent some like a weekend there. And
did you know you wanted to study theater or art or whatever?
I knew I wanted to write. I was, when I got there, I was thinking maybe more journalism.
Oh, really?
Yeah. And I did a few journalism classes the first like
not funny.
Year. Bored out of my skull. So boring. And so then I also had loved television and so started taking film and TV classes, and that's sort of
just
where
to check,
I...
Just to see? Just to see
yeah,
how
just
it felt.
To see, and that felt much more correct.
How did that start? Like, what are those classes like at NYU? When you like you when you're just sort of like, oh, I'm going to take a film and TV class.
There, I mean, some of it is like theory, just like watching films and talking about them,
sure.
and then you get into the more like doing short film, making short films with other people in the class.
Quickly?
Happens pretty quickly. It happens the second year of the program that you're making like short films.
So you were able to see like. Pretty quickly that like, oh, this is how this stuff is made.
Yeah. It does throw you in to it pretty quickly of like, okay, go make a thing and go screen it for the class and get feedback
things?
On it. I did, yeah. I learned, it also was
Are
a learning.
Hilarious?
They're really good. I've been asking my agents to
get them out
find
there.
A platform. Yeah.
I know I just won an Emmy, but could you get that short out that I did at NYU?
Yeah.
That I shot in Washington Square Park with stop action?
Yeah. No, but it was instructive, I remember. I mean, God, if I watched them now, I would be horrified, of course. But I do remember, like, you had to make, like, 3 or 4 short films, like, it was a class called Sight and Sound.
Yeah, yeah.
And you had to make 4 films. And I did like 3 that were like funny, supposed to be funny. And then the 4th one, I remember the teacher said, why don't you challenge yourself and do something that's more dramatic, not comedy? And I was like, sure. And I did it, and it was something where this couple was—I don't even remember exactly, but they're like playfully flirting in the street, and then his hat gets tossed, and he goes into the street to get his hat, and he gets hit by a car.
Wow!
The whole class burst out into laughter because it was just—I think maybe they were like, "She makes the funny things. This is hilarious," or maybe it's objectively so funny because it's so insane.
Yeah. But that's so funny. That was your idea when you said to be more dramatic.
Exactly.
No problem.
No. You want drama? He dies going to get his hat. Yeah.
And just leaves her standing there.
Exactly.
She sees the whole thing.
It was so bad. It was so bad. But it did make me go like, I guess I'll just lean into this other.
But it's so funny that people would assume like that a teacher would, like comedy's the hard thing.
Yeah. Yeah.
Drama, like, I mean, it's not.
I don't
that
know. That drama was hard for me. I couldn't do it. I came up with the guy
with
running
that.
In the
sure,
street.
Sure, but I mean, I guess it just seems like there's a lot more options.
Yeah.
With drama.
Yeah.
Right?
Yeah.
You know, and that comedy, it's got to be funny.
Yeah, I do think that sometimes when I'm writing, you know, there is this natural barometer of like, okay, is this scene funny?
Yeah.
And I do sometimes wonder if you're writing a drama. I guess it's just, is this scene interesting? Is this scene?
If you're like, can we take this joke out? Is it like, it's not reading right.
Yeah.
Yeah, it's almost like, I don't know if it's the opposite, but yeah, things gotta land differently.
Right, yeah.
But there's a lot of drama, at least in Hacks. There's
there is.
So where does that take you? Where does NYU, like, where do you land? Who in these movies, were there any people in your class that we know, actors? I always like hearing when they're actors in short films where it's sort of like, John Turturro did my short film.
No one that was like in my shorts. I was the same year as some like the Olsen twins and Lady Gaga were my year.
Really?
Yeah.
Did you know Lady Gaga?
I hung out with her a couple times. We were like we had a friend in common.
Yeah.
And so we were in the same like circle. So I've been at the same like hangout as her, Stephanie Germanotta.
Yeah.
But never really had like one-on-one interaction. And I'm going to assume she doesn't know.
That me. You hung out with her?
I'm going to assume
But what was
that,
she
yeah.
doing there? She was singing?
She was singing, yeah.
Do you remember
singing.
Seeing her? Did you see her singing?
I remember her performing at the Bitter End. Yeah.
You do?
Yeah, because our connection was this guy, Alex, who was a friend or like friendly with the group of guys I was hanging with. And he was her either drummer or guitarist in that band. Yeah.
Oh, in college?
In college,
now,
yeah.
Now, like, were you... Because she's kind of amazing, right?
She's incredible.
Yeah.
Yeah.
I mean, when you go see her in college, did you sense that?
You were like, there's something incredibly special about this person.
Really?
Like, sometimes there's people you're like, oh, I didn't realize they were going to be something. But her voice alone, it's hard to not.
Yeah.
Like, yeah, there's something incredibly
it's so funny.
Special here.
In
yeah.
comedy, it's always sort of like, that guy? You never.
That is true.
Rarely do you see the gift.
Right. But do you think that's because we are comedians, so we're bringing something else to it? Or do you, like, because I can look at a musician and have that feeling with no attachment to it, but wonder if.
Even an actor, in
right.
a way.
Yeah.
No, because comedy, you know, comedians have to, some guys get funny. I mean, you got to figure it out for yourself. I mean, a lot of times, like, first 5 years, you're kind of this unformed thing as a stand-up, and you're kind of doing like your version of somebody else or a number of people, or but it takes a while for people to kind of like step into themselves.
Yeah,
because I think not unlike music, only you know, it's a different skill. You know, you gotta, it takes a while to become who you are,
right?
To have
right.
a voice.
Yeah. Yeah.
Whereas an actor, you know, you just got to be whatever that is.
Right. You have to be present with what you're given for a script. Yeah. And you're also, I've always been very struck by that thing. People say that when you first start out, you're kind of just imitating the people who you love and admire. And it does. It
inadvertently,
takes a while.
In a way.
Yeah. Inadvertently. And then you have to kind of lock into your own voice.
Oh, yeah. When I was coming up, there was about a dozen Dave Attells around. And then there was. There was a handful of Hedbergs. It just kind of, you saw certain people who had distinct voices, you know, ripple through the newbies.
Right.
I have no idea what's going on out there now. All I know is there's a lot of them. And I'm not sure that they're all funny.
Right. Do you try to keep up with it or?
I can't. I mean, I go work. I mean, I work at the comedy store, you know, most of the nights I'm home.
Yeah.
So if people are coming through there, I see them. But I'm not going to mics.
Uh-huh,
and I'm not to see who the comers are, you know?
Sure, sure.
And I guess I could watch more specials. I don't, and I tend to be a bit of a cranky old guy.
I get that.
When it, you know, I'll watch 5 minutes and be like, nah, not going to, can't do it.
Right.
Not ready. So what was your first gig coming out of there? What did it set you up to do?
So I went to NYU, did film and TV, and then I, when I graduated, I had been an intern at The Onion.
You know, version of that? Who was there? Who was running the place?
So it was...
Was Hansen still there?
Todd Hansen?
Yeah.
Right? Yeah, yeah. So I was an intern, not for the paper, even though I ended up writing headlines for the paper, but I was an intern for their like web video department.
So that relatively new department when you were there?
Yeah, it was pretty new that they were bought by someone who said like, oh, you should start doing web videos.
Oh,
so
that must have been right when they were bought.
Yeah, exactly.
Right.
So I was an intern there and met some people there. And so my first year out of NYU, I was like, I worked at a coffee shop.
Where? What one?
Grey Dog Coffee.
Oh, yeah? Where's that? Down on?
It's in a bunch of, when I was there, they had like three locations.
Is there one in Soho?
Yeah. There was one in Soho. There was one in West Village.
It's still there, right?
Yeah, they have a few. They're still there. I haven't been in forever. But there was one in University Place by Union Square. There was one in West Village, one in Chelsea, one in Soho.
How's The Onion work? How did that work over there?
So it was
in terms of writing.
Yeah, it was for me as a. I don't know exactly how it worked with the editorial, like people who were on staff. But I was a freelance headline writer, which meant every week you would send in like. I don't know, 25.
So they're almost like just writing jokes.
Yeah, just writing jokes.
And someone else would fill in the text?
Yes, I think the actual staff writers were the ones writing the stories, whereas freelance writers like myself were just sending in headlines.
Oh, so that's where it starts. It can all start with the headline, then you just fill it in.
Exactly. And I'm sure those writers were pitching like, oh, this is the headline and the full piece. But for me, it was just headlines you would send in every week, and then you would... you know, get it sent back to you of what they chose or didn't.
That's exciting.
It was, because I was a huge Onion fan, like as a NYU kid, and so it was very exciting.
When they had the boxes all over New York, and you could just go get a free Onion.
I know.
Was pretty funny,
It was very funny. Very funny.
What was the video trip?
So then the video trip was they hired this guy, Will Graham, to run their web videos. And it was basically the kind of the same, you know, humor and brand of The Onion, but done with, you know, under the guise of a news network, Onion News Network.
Oh, and right. So, I kind of remember that.
Yeah. Yeah.
Yeah.
That's what we were going for. I kind of remember that.
I miss everything, though.
I know, yeah. And so basically, I did that. I was an intern there. I worked at a coffee shop for like a year. I was doing a bunch of comedy in different ways. I was doing improv and sketch and even trying stand-up, which I was very bad at.
Where were you doing the improv and sketch?
UCB.
Taking classes?
Taking classes at UCB.
With who?
Doing, oh man, I'm trying to think of, Bobby Moynihan was my first teacher.
Oh, really?
He was great. Yeah.
Yeah.
Wonderful guy. Shannon O'Neill. but taking classes and then doing like a...
At the old one, the theater that used to be the...
Exactly, oh, the theater in Chelsea. Going there a ton. Like
the dirty theater. It used to be
dirty,
the dirty
under the grocery store. Yeah. But seeing a ton of comedy there, just like so, so much improv.
Who was
sketch.
At it then? Who were the big names?
Who
surfaced out of that period?
Well, the
was
the,
it the Krolls and the
Kroll,
Aziz?
Yeah, Kroll, Aziz, yeah. Jeselnik. I remember seeing a bunch. They had like
doing
a
stand-up?
Yeah, doing stand up. They had a Monday night show called Whiplash, where I remember
sure,
seeing.
Sure, Whiplash is still around.
Is Whiplash still around?
I think it might still be around. Yeah.
I would go every Monday. I saw Mulaney, I think.
Sure.
But the you know, I was such a huge Amy Poehler fan. So it being her theater and the chance to like go on Sunday night for ASCAT and see like her.
Did you see her?
Yeah. And Tina and those people were like, that was to me the coolest thing. I mean, gosh, 2007. I was in college 2004 to 2008.
Okay. All right. And the stand-up thing you didn't take?
God, no. It's so hard,
you
man.
You tried, huh?
It's so hard. I give you a lot of credit.
You gave it a whirl?
Gave it a whirl. It just wasn't... It was so lonely to me.
Yeah.
I really like collaborating. I really like working with other people.
It's a healthier
people.
Thing. And I think your longevity and your odds are better when you collaborate as opposed
guess,
to just be a stubborn idiot who goes it alone. You know, it definitely limits your possibilities.
Yeah. But I, you know, it's also like some of my favorite comedians like are stand-ups. And what they do is so special and important. So I commend the art form. It is just not for me because it's too hard.
Well, yeah. I mean, I guess what was it hard for you exactly? Because you probably could write jokes, right?
Yeah, I was writing. It was very like one liner.
Yeah. It's just figuring out who's delivering them.
Yeah, I think what it was, and I really didn't even give it that much of a try. I think I think the level to probably what it is like. We're all working out our shit through every part of our life. And like, I think growing up the way I did, I was looking more for structure and family and people that way.
That makes sense.
And so even though I do think there is a stand-up community and,
it's forced upon us.
A reluctant stand-up community. Like, I really think what I needed more than anything was people, this surrogate kind of family, people around me to collaborate with and feel like I was part of a unit that way.
As opposed to competing.
I think I had felt on my own for a long time.
Yeah, I imagine. Well, only kid thing is kind of, I always make assumptions about only kids and I'm always wrong.
Like they're selfish. They don't know how to share.
No. My thing is like, you know, it was always sort of like, were your parents more worried because there was not another one?
Right.
And none of them have really said yes.
Yeah.
Yeah.
I don't know.
Yeah.
I don't think that, it wasn't my experience.
Because that would be my thoughts. Like, you're it.
Yeah.
You know, don't die.
Yeah. If there's three, I can lose one.
Exactly.
Yeah.
You did that, did The Onion, then you move on. When do you start doing TV stuff?
So I did The Onion. I was an intern and then they hired me to be an assistant when there were two very short-lived shows, one on IFC and one on Comedy Central that the Onion
News?
Did. Onion News Network was the IFC one and Onion Sports Dome was on Comedy Central and I was the writer's assistant for that.
So you're in the room typing?
In the room typing.
Listening to a bunch of men make jokes?
Exactly. Actually, they were, I gotta say, all the Onion Sports Dome writers were very, they were all men, don't get me wrong, but they were very sweet,
good.
Well-behaved men.
Yeah.
But, did that, and then kind of had an interesting thing happen where, you know, then this becomes like 2010, 2011, and Twitter becomes a place where people are writing jokes, like little one-liner things, which I was pretty used to doing from, you know, doing Onion headlines. And
this 2010?
This is 2010,
So Twitter's been like 2 years or?
Yeah, I guess.
Just starting to take
2008,
off.
2008, 2009, I'm not sure exactly.
Yeah, yeah.
But it was that time when like Rob Delaney, for example, was hitting huge. Because,
doing his weird.
Doing his Twitter jokes. And so I started doing that and getting a little bit of attention that way. And when The Onion ended, like when those seasons were up, I said, like, I think it's time to move to LA. I want to be a TV writer. It feels like, even though I love New York, I've been here a while, it feels like I have a better chance of becoming a TV writer out in LA.
Yeah.
And so I moved to LA in January of 2011. And in, I think, March, I get a DM from 80 Miles, the head writer of Late Night with Jimmy Fallon at the time, saying, hey, I like you on Twitter. Do you want to submit a packet or whatever? I did. I got the job.
I go
back to New York 3 months later from when I packed up.
80 Miles. So it was at the beginning of the
it was pretty close
Fallon
to the
run?
Yeah, it was pretty close to the beginning. It was like 2000. I think Fallon took over in like 2009. Uh-huh. This was 2000. So it was like 2 years into the run.
Wow. Who's in the writer's room?
At the time, it was, I'm trying to think of who you would know. This guy, Jeremy Bronson, was the head monologue writer.
Yeah.
Justin Shaines, a very dear, good friend of mine to this day. Eric Legend, Amy Ozels, Patrick Borelli.
I know him.
Yeah.
He's a Boston guy.
Yeah. I love Borelli.
But so you're on the monologue crew?
So what happened was, as I was, they were looking for sketch writers, and I was hired as a sketch writer, and it's pretty quickly realized I was horrible at sketch writing.
Really?
Yeah. Like, not horrible, just like...
Like my, what, goofy desk pieces?
Yeah. Just like games, goofy desk pieces. Like, it just wasn't my thing. My thing was, I kept getting reoriented back to like joke writing.
Right.
You know, and so what it was as a sketch writer, you were welcome to submit monologue jokes. And so I did that, and then I started getting enough on that they were like, well, either I got enough on or I got enough not on the sketch side that they were like, do you want to switch over and become a monologue writer? And so, I did.
So that was it, the first big writing job.
That was the first big writing job. Yeah, Late Night.
And how long do you stay there?
I was there from April 2011 to February 2013. So like a little under 2 years.
That's very specific, joke writing.
Very specific. I mean, monologue joke writing especially,
and now you're
so
the,
specific.
Like the co-creator of this big, you know, comedy, you know, show that's about a life. I mean, how do you make the jump? What's the next step in the evolution from just writing one-liners for Fallon to, you know, where do you go next?
So
I guess my question is, at some point someone taught you something.
Yeah, right.
Or the experience did.
I think what it was is like I was, you know, the Late Night experience was great because it taught, you know, it's like joke writing boot camp in a way. You have to write so many every day, but it was also like extremely exhausting.
And limited too, in a way.
You have, you know, you're writing jokes about the news that day, and that's all you're doing. And so I knew that I wanted to write more about characters and people, and so I left, and pretty quickly after I got hired, my first narrative job was a show called Hello Ladies, which you probably wouldn't remember, but it was Stephen Merchant's show HBO.
Was it like one season thing?
It was just one season.
Yeah, I remember,
But that was wonderful because I'm a huge Stephen Merchant fan and got to...
Gotta be a sweet boss.
So sweet.
Was Fallon all right? He's sweet too, right?
Really sweet. Yeah. Really sweet guy,
I like going on Fallon. It's weird. Because he got so much flack at first for being so goofy and childlike.
I know.
But he's a genuine audience.
Yeah.
Like when you go out there, he's just sort of like, are you going to do it?
Yeah. That's the thing is like, I could see if the truth is like that is Jimmy. He's he's a big kid in that way. And so it's like that it's authentic to who he is.
He likes when you do it.
Yeah.
Like
he's
ready to laugh.
Yeah.
So Hello Ladies.
So that was a kind of shorter job, but lucky to learn a lot from him.
Did you write a script?
Didn't write a script there. It was a quick job, and I was just a staff writer, so like lowest on the totem pole, so didn't get a script. But the place that then I did learn pretty much everything about how to write TV comedy narrative is from Mike Schur on Parks and Rec. I went to Parks and Rec, and I worked there for the last two seasons.
Huh.
And then I worked on The Good Place, Mike Schur's next show, for all four seasons of that.
So he liked you.
I guess, yeah.
So Parks and Rec, well, that's a big one.
Yeah, it was.
And you're working with Poehler?
Yeah, Poehler, who, was a massive. I have never been more nervous to do anything in my life than start that show, because it was in the sixth season, and it was my favorite show.
How many were there?
There were seven, so I was on for the last two.
Got it, right, yeah.
You know, Mike Schur was one of my favorite writers. Yeah. I was a massive Harris Whittles fan. He was in the room. Joe Mandy. Like, this writer's room was stacked with people I was massive fans of. The cast was stacked with people.
Is that where you met Mandy?
Yeah, that's where I met Mandy.
And do you give him this job he's got now?
I was lucky that Mandy came aboard Hacks. Yes.
Yeah.
But yeah, it was. I learned so much about writing TV from Mike and from that room and The Good Place and yeah.
So that was where you wrote your first episodes.
That's where I wrote my first episode. Yeah.
So you'd break them in the room, then go out and write them.
Break them in the room and go out and write them. Yeah.
And come back and break them again.
Mm-hmm. Well, hopefully not. Right. Hopefully
right.
Only
maybe a couple tweaks.
Only some dialogue tweaks changes, but you never. Yeah. Sometimes it's a full re-break.
And what was when did you do the Broad City stuff?
So in my time at UCB. In a sketch group at UCB, I was in a sketch group with Lucia Agnello, who became obviously my co-collaborator and best friend.
Wow, so you go for that far back?
That far back, yeah. 2007.
We were at UCB.
It's like it was an offshoot of UCB. It was some UCB people who were doing stuff on the side, and I met her doing that, and then I met Paul Downs through her, and so because 2007, 2008.
Really?
Yeah. So we've known each other a very long time.
Wow.
And I was kind of just instantly, they were the funniest people in the world to me, and I just wanted to stay in their orbit. So throughout this whole career, you know, Onion and Fallon and that, like, they've been, you know, two of my best friends, and we always stayed in touch. But also, like, you know, they, I would sometimes, like, do, you know, punch up on Paul's like sketch specials or you know, and then yes, we worked more closely together on Broad City, which I did in between seasons of Parks and Rec. That was my first time doing Broad City, was in between season six and
Paul
seven.
Was on there.
Yep, Paul's on there. Yeah,
did he act on that too?
He did. Yeah,
I remember.
Yeah, he plays Trey, the gym trainer.
Right, right. Yeah. And then what about with Maria? When were you working with Maria?
Oh, Marie Bamford, who my favorite.
I figured, yeah. She's the best.
So after Parks and Rec ended, in between Parks and Rec and Good Place, the show that I worked on was Lady Dynamite for Netflix.
Now, how was that as an experience? Because, you know, Maria has a specific thing that is specifically Maria.
Yeah.
And Hurwitz, is that who that was?
Yeah, Mitch Hurwitz.
Mitch Hurwitz also a kind of an out there guy, willing to take risks.
Yeah.
So, like, I mean, Broad City was interesting and good and new, but Parks and Rec and The Good Place were pretty established shows.
Yeah.
But imagine walking into Lady Dynamite, it was like going into orbit somehow.
I mean, yeah. Well, I think what it is like it was kind of this very lovely meeting of minds, in that Maria is such a genius, unique brain.
Yeah.
Mitch is also that, but Mitch is so also, you know, Arrested Development is incredible, and he's so good at story and structure.
Sure.
So, like, he has that. And then also Pam Brady was the showrunner, who someone who, you know, done a ton, worked on South Park forever, very established, like, person who knows how to make television movie. And so it was a really good collaborative process in that way, because I think, you know, like you're saying, you don't naturally see Maria's stand-up as amazing as it is and go, oh, here's how that could be a narrative television show. But I think that it's indicative of what I really love about television, is that it was just a collaborative process. It wasn't just Maria going, here's what I want to do, and can you write that up for me? Thanks, bye. It was very, all three of their brains at the top of the show, and then the writer's room working to figure it out.
That's amazing. Yeah, because there was what, three seasons?
Two seasons. I did the first season, and then I left for Good Place. But yeah, I did the first season.
And Good Place, that must have been a fun crew.
It was very fun.
I like Kristen a lot.
Kristen's great. Love Kristen.
Ted's wild too.
Really good. Ted is an incredible actor, because you know he could be an asshole. Like, his pedigree suggests, like, hey, maybe he'll be a jerk, but hey, he's earned it, and he is the nicest, kindest, also so like, hey, did I get that right?
Yeah.
So open to
real
hearing.
Actor.
Yeah, real actor. Like, really lovely.
When was the last time you watched Body Heat?
Oh my gosh, long time.
It's crazy to see him in that.
I bet.
This weird dancing DA. He's always dancing around. I just wonder whose choice that was. I must have asked him when I talked to him.
He's incredible. He is such a obvious on-screen person, is amazing, but like off-screen too, so wonderful to work with. And yeah, it was another thing where, you know, the lovely thing about my career is like all these people that I've came up with, like my best friend Darcy Carden was also in the cast of that show, and so I got to work with her for 4 years. Like, it's all these people that I met at UCB or through offshoots of UCB that were all kind of now working together.
That's the way it works. That's the difference between sketch and stand-up.
Yeah. Well, you must see. Yeah.
Well, I know the guys. You know, yeah. Sure. Like, you know, but they're still doing stand-up.
Sure.
Some of them
sure.
build shows and whatnot. Yeah. But in terms of coming up around sketch and improv, is that you do kind of meet a variety of people doing different things.
Mm-hmm.
You know, acting and writing, and everybody sort of, you know, engaged in that. You know,
yeah.
It's not just this sort of like, you know, I only do me.
Exactly.
It all has to come through me.
Right. And then, exactly. You know. Yeah.
So they're kind of available and kind of looking for stuff.
Right.
You know?
Right.
But so when do you start? Whose concept is Hacks? How does that unfold?
So, yeah.
Because I like the show and I shouldn't. when I first turned it on, I'm like, let's see if they get the comedy thing right.
Yeah, well, I have to say, it is a tremendous compliment that you like it, because when we started making the show,
all you were saying was like,
Mark Maron like this? Yeah, that was, we put it on the top of
the
whiteboard. Yeah,
make sure Maron likes
but
it.
But we were like, will stand-ups tear this apart? Like, we were very wanted to be deferential to this form.
How does it start, though? How do you come up with this thing? Whose concept?
So basically, Paul Lucci and I had worked together on a bunch of stuff, kept working together, best friends, traveled together, all that. And
right.
so on a, we were, Paul was shooting a special for Netflix, a sketch special called The Characters. And this was in,
I remember,
Yeah, this was in 2015.
Okay.
And Lucia was directing some and writing it with him. And they asked me to come along just for like punch up. And, you know, that's kind of what we do. I trick them into letting me collaborate with them on everything.
Right.
And so we drive up to, he was performing at a monster truck rally in Portland, Maine. He has a character called Jasper Cooch.
Okay.
And Jasper Cooch was going to kind of MC
for the
this
show
monster,
or
for the sketch. Yeah,
okay,
MC this monster truck rally. And we're driving up to Maine, and we're just kind of talking about female stand-ups, particularly that like we kind of felt, you know, there was just a. They're talked about in a different light. They're not. There's fewer of them because it was a markedly harder path for them to get famous and known. And we just start talking about kind of women like that. And then also kind of talking about this thing that happens about like comedy and cool comedy and comedy that people look down on. You know, this idea of like, why is some comedy, you know, why is someone like, for example, Kathy Griffin, who's so funny and so accomplished, but like maybe, you know, someone would look down on what she's done as not as like cool as other comedy.
Well, that used to be that way with Robin Williams.
Yeah.
And that's why I interviewed Robin Williams, because I got, you know, whether I was a huge fan of Robin or not, he's still Robin Williams.
Exactly.
And to hear these young idiots sort of like, ugh, Robin Williams, what a hack. I'm like, do you even know what you're fucking saying?
Yeah.
The guy did everything you want to do and more. And you're going to be like, nah.
Exactly. And so we kind of like felt it was a very fertile ground, not to just make a show about stand-up because that had been done and you know, but make
had it? Well, no.
Well,
like what? What are you thinking? Seinfeld, but that's not really even a show about
Seinfeld.
Stand-up.
Or I don't know. Or it just felt like, I guess the point is like when you pitch a show, you can't just say it's about a stand-up. It's like the thing that was the meat of it that really kind of got us talking and we felt energized by was this idea of this clash between older and younger generations about a lot of things, but when it comes to comedy, like what is cool, what is not, why does someone who stands on the shoulder of this person then say like, eh, but what they did is hacky and not good.
Sure. Oh yeah, that's just insecurity and jealousy usually.
Usually, yeah. but so then, you know, we just start talking about that idea and it kind of stuck in our, you know, I don't know if you have this with ideas or ideas for stand-up, but like the things, like you have an idea and then sometimes it just drifts away and you never think about it again. Yeah. You don't do it. But this one kind of like kept coming around. We kept having little, we had like an email chain where we would just email each other like, oh, this could be an episode or this could be a joke.
Like, but I thought that the idea to set it, the reason why I took to it is because you took a very specific stand-up career. And it's one that's it's almost singular. That's it doesn't, it's not the grind, you know, it's the sort of the putting out to passion. It's the, it's where a certain type of performer ends up in Vegas.
Right.
So like that's a very specialized life.
Yes. Yes.
And it enabled you to avoid a lot of the problems that could happen with a stand-up life.
Right. Doing it like a strictly showbiz in Los Angeles.
Right.
Yeah.
Because I think getting that thing right, you know, this sort of indulgence and comfort of having what do you call it? A residency that goes on forever.
Right. Yeah.
Because there are a few guys that have that.
Yeah.
But it's not that many.
No. Yeah.
So I thought that was like you kind of insulated yourself in a world and were able to explore it without me going like, they don't fucking get comedy, you know?
Right. Well, I'm glad to hear that.
Yeah. And I mean, I knew people like, you know, I knew some of the women, you know, back in the day, like Brett Butler, for some reason, stands out in my mind.
Yeah.
That could have been where she ended
right.
up. You know, like that.
Right.
And the whole backstory I thought was kind of genius too, because I know Caroline Ray very well. I mean, there are definitely women of a certain generation. Caroline's not as old as Jean, obviously, but where it seemed plausible to me.
Yeah, yeah. Well, it's also the thing of, in our show, Deborah, Jean Smart's character, like, she goes out there. She's proud of what she's built out there, but it's also a little bit of a being shunned by the LA, New York machine and world, and kind of insulating yourself in that Vegas world. And I've never spoken to a comic who has a residency there. I don't know how they would feel, but it's interesting to ask yourself, because as far as Deborah, she does have a chip on her shoulder about kind of not being accepted
Her husband and
exactly,
what happened to the
exactly.
talk show. Well, I mean, I think a lot of those people that get that, they're actually true comics.
Yeah.
Is what the issue is.
Right.
It's not so much that they failed, but it's just like, you know, they started out as comics. They probably had several shots
right.
to do other things, and they ended up as comics.
Yeah.
And then they just go do that thing.
Right.
That is a career of a comic.
Right. Which is
of a certain type.
Yeah. Which it's like, it's almost strange that isn't seen in and of itself as a massive accomplishment. You know, like it's this need to ask comics to do other things is interesting. Like, I'm curious how you feel. Like, are you like, I am a comic through, and that is the thing I want to do at the end of the day, and acting and all the other stuff is kind of...
Yeah, as time goes on, that's true. I mean, that's what I set out to do, and at my core, I am that.
Yeah.
But I'm definitely not. I don't even want to play a casino, so I'm not that kind of comic.
Uh-huh.
Like, I don't want to.
Why don't you want to?
Because I don't feel like my audience, they'd rather not go there.
Yep. Yeah, yeah.
So, you know, I mean, I know my audience.
Right.
It's not huge, but it's good.
Yeah.
And, you know, if I don't have to drag them to the casino... They'll be happier.
Yeah,
I mean,
yeah.
I could do a little theater. I could do
right.
a club
yeah.
where they'd feel more comfortable as opposed to being sucked into that world.
Right. Right.
I don't love that world, but I get
yeah.
it. I get that show business.
Right. Right.
But in terms of like, you know, you got George Wallace, you got Brad Garrett.
Yeah.
You got, who else do I know? Like, well, Joan Rivers had these.
Yeah,
some
yeah.
of them had runs forever.
Yeah.
Carrot Top's been out there for decades,
Carrot
it
Top's
seems.
Been a really long time. Yeah. Yeah.
So for me, I mean, the question is, I see myself as a comic, but I guess your question is like, you never understood how these comics are, like what happens exactly. There was a whole model in place where, you know, the big goal was to get a show built around your character.
On TV.
Yeah.
Yeah.
So like once that didn't work out,
right.
then the only other option is, well, you can host something.
Right, right.
So either you're going to be the center of a show or you're going to host something or you're going to be like a side player.
Right. I guess that's sort of the thing that I have like an aversion to is like the, and again, this is just show business, how it works, and money is probably the answer just to these things. But like, why is there this like never ending, like, well, but what else? What else do you want to do? Even now, having a show, which I'm very proud of, people will say, like, well, are you going to do another show? Like, what's, are you going to have like a bunch of shows? You're going to produce a bunch of shows? You know, like, there's this, it's never enough. And so it's interesting that as a super successful comic.
Who's asking that though? If that's the industry asking that, it's, well, it's not that it's never enough. They're just sort of like, they want to get a jump on it.
Maybe, but, maybe, yeah.
Yeah. Yeah, I mean, like, you developing anything? You working on anything? Like, I mean, you know, you're the symbiotic thing that, or it, maybe it's not symbiotic. However, the dynamic is between, you know, agents, you know, yeah, managers, networks,
right,
and in development.
Yeah,
I mean, it's never just sort of like, we're just curious, you know, as a friend, you know,
yeah,
like, what are you working on?
Yeah,
you
yeah
know?
No, no, that, well, that's what I mean. I guess the answer in the end of the day is money.
Yeah, well, I mean, it's also keeping the ball rolling. They get invested, you know, yeah, once you're a commodity. Yeah,
right.
I mean, they want to run money through you.
Yeah, right. But it's interesting, is like, if a comic was just like, I don't want a show based around me. I want to do stand-up. You know, like, it's...
Well, there are guys who have done that. I mean, you yeah know, Hannibal Buress famously, you know, kind of quit SNL.
Yeah.
And I think Mulaney might have, in a way,
yeah, yeah,
to do other things, and ended up as a stand-up. And, like, Carlin talks about all the time that at some point he realized, like, I can't act.
Right.
I'm a comic, and I got to yeah figure out how to make this work.
Right.
You know, but I think it was the business of the 80s,
mm-hmm,
it became this huge business.
Right.
Giving comics development deals to try to make, you know,
make their,
Everybody Loves Ray or yeah Jerry. I mean, Brett Butler got a shot, you know, Roseanne. There were all these shows, Tim Allen, they were built around that, her generation,
yeah,
Deborah's
yeah
generation of comics.
Right, yeah.
And also the other thing is, what are you going to do, man? I mean, how are you going to, like, you know, there's so many comics that just fall away. Or
right
they find, how are you going to retire? How are you going to age out of this thing?
Right.
How are you going to save fucking money?
Right, right.
I mean, to see the guys that are sort of sentenced to the road out of mm-hmm no choice.
Yeah.
It's rough, man.
Right. There's not, yeah, the TV and movies and those opportunities give you more stability and security.
If you
that
can
way
keep them going, but everyone ages out of that shit. So, like, something like that happens with the character of Deborah is like, it's a real gift. I mean, it could afford you the ability to at least have a second part of your life that isn't desperate.
Right, right, yeah.
You know, I'm just thinking about, like, that episode in this season where she, I don't know where you're at. Are they showing them all yet?
Yeah, yeah.
Oh, they're all done.
Yeah.
Where she meets a woman that, you know, was doing comedy with her. That was such a real thing.
Yeah.
And, of course, her ego was like that. I ruined it. But but it was such a, you know, that happens. And it's always weird.
It's always weird, yeah.
But as I get older, I'm always thrilled to meet somebody that has gotten out and done okay.
Yeah, me too. I feel that, like, we talked a lot in the room as we wrote that episode about this feeling of when you run into someone who quit or stopped doing it.
You think that they must think they're a failure.
Yeah, it's like so funny how, like, the way Deborah handled it, like, oh, I'm pitying her, and then realizing, like, no, she's pitying me. I'm the pathetic one because I'm desperately doing a stand-up show at 4:30 in the afternoon at a state fair.
The twisted kind of, like, this idea that we have about show business, you know, about how it's like this revered thing.
Yeah.
And most people think we're just wasting time.
I know.
They're like, is that even a real job?
Yeah.
What do you do?
I know.
But I think it speaks to our fear as well. Like, how, because when I started the podcast, I was kind of washed up or not washed yet or something,
mm-hmm,
but it wasn't happening.
Yeah.
Though I was still engaged and had done enough. It was just sort of, how do I take the next step? And how do you quit
right
this game?
Yeah.
It's the same
hard
with writing.
Yeah.
Because, like, it's all up to you anyways.
Yes.
So, you know, either you don't realize you're done, you know, and it becomes sad.
It's become sad. Yeah, someone else tells you you're done.
Yeah, and you fight that.
Yeah.
There's no way your ego can, you know, it takes a very sort of strange and humbled ego to bow out of this thing.
Yeah,
I know. If it's not working out.
But it is, like, when you meet someone and they're doing great, why do you think that is, that it gives you a sense of relief? To me, because I'll tell you what, I know what it is for me.
When they get out.
Yeah. I know what it is.
What is it?
For me, it's even though I'm very lucky to do what I do and I'm at a very good moment in my career, it's the fantasy of that I could not do it and be okay.
Sure.
I think it's the fantasy of the torturous parts of the creative process being free of them, I think, is what it is.
I guess for me, like, I don't, in my mind, like, I didn't have any choices. Like, I don't know what I would have done.
Yeah.
And as you get older, those even get farther away.
Yeah.
Like, whatever the idea is, like, I could teach, or, you know, whatever that, you know, like,
right.
I'm not going to work at a restaurant.
Yeah, yeah.
So,
yeah.
Like, those things start to go away. And then what I start to realize, the reason that, you know, I'm glad they're doing okay, is because I think there is priorities that people choose,
yeah,
over this kind of, like, need to do this creative thing.
Right.
Like, whether they're willing to take the hit on the creative thing to have families or live in a different place or, you know, enjoy life, period.
Yeah. Yep.
And if I can look at them and see that they are actually doing that, I'm like, well, good for you.
Yeah.
But I always look sort of like, really, though? I mean, I'm the asshole. It's like, you're happy, though,
yeah,
huh?
But
I
mean, but you need, that's the, like, sick part of us that makes us keep doing it.
But, yeah, but I like the idea that, like, the one who had gotten out pitied Deborah.
Yeah.
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 Because there's so many of them. And there's so, like, I don't know what happens to a lot of them. And at the Comedy Store, you know, you go to the Comedy Store and there's 8x10s everywhere of, you know, like, going back 50 or 60 years of people that have come through there. And every once in a while, one will come in real life and you'll be like, oh my God.
Wow.
That's the guy from the picture.
To do a set, or just to see.
There's this moment where you're like, where have you been, man?
Mm-hmm.
And they, a lot of them find their way, you know, or it might not be great, but they're all right.
It's also like, I think, like, thinking about it makes me consider luck and how big of a part of that it is, and how
everything, you know, kind of coming together.
Everything coming together.
The cosmic timing.
Exactly. Like, that's also what I used to find it so unfair that it was such a big part of it, and now I just kind of go, like, well, it's the way
I don't know if it's just luck, because a lot of times, you know, it's somehow everything kind of coming together. It's not lucky, though. You make decisions about casting. I think the luck of it just comes on behalf of somehow an executive made a decision to say okay.
Sure, exactly.
Who the hell knows what that day is?
It's certainly not just luck.
Sure.
But yet I can speak to a number of writers who, you know what I mean? Like, this very talented people,
sure,
who it hasn't happened in one way or another for. And that is the part of it that you just go, yeah, it's like you said, it's
tough business.
Yeah, the stars aligning.
Why'd you do it?
I had no choice. Like
Get
you
out.
Said, I had
yeah.
no choice.
Right, right. Right, because, like, now I'm sad, because when people are like, if I wanted to start doing comedy, what would you say? Like, nah, we're all filled up.
No vacancy. Come back later, yeah.
But I don't even know. I'm just old now, you know what I mean?
There's
two or three generations behind me, and they're doing okay, I guess.
Yeah.
I don't know who they are, a lot of them, but they seem to be doing okay. But I don't know. The entire business is different. What okay means now is something I may never see.
Right.
There could be a guy that just bought his third house doing a very popular thing, and I don't even know how to get it on my phone.
Right. Yeah, it's true. It's changing. It feels like it's changing at lightning speed, too.
Yeah, it's just watching the actual networks kind of, like, just desperately hang on,
yeah,
you know? It's kind of wild.
Yeah.
But like something like Hacks, though, it seems popular. You're doing good, right? In terms of this, the marketplace anyway.
We hit a lucky thing where it seems like we got critics on our side, but also there's a general audience as well.
People like it.
People like it, yeah.
What's it on?
It's on HBO Max.
Oh, yeah.
Yeah.
But not. But is that the difference? Is that different than HBO?
HBO is the, like, more linear, like, you have to have cable and have HBO.
But it's also on HBO.
Our show is on HBO Max, but okay, not HBO.
Oh.
But HBO, here's the trick.
Yeah.
HBO shows are on HBO and HBO Max.
I get it.
Yeah.
Yeah. So has that stuck in your craw?
No. Thanks for taking my
It's probably better
about
it's
that.
On the streaming service. Better.
Yeah. I mean, most people I know, that's how they watch everything
HBO
anyway.
I just have Apple TV.
Right, and then it aggregates everything.
Yeah. And I get through Hulu. I get my cable through Hulu.
Yeah.
Because I'm not a sports guy. There's no reason for me to have a fucking dish on my roof.
Right.
Or a wire coming into my house.
Right.
But Well, that's great. And how did, what was casting, what was the casting like? I mean, it-
so we sold the show to HBO Max and we knew that it kind of like lived in, you know, died by who plays Deborah Vance. Like it's a very tricky thing. And
did you think of comics?
No, we kind of, I mean, not, you know, not that there aren't many wonderful comics who are also incredible actors, but we knew that the show, we wanted the tone to be kind of equally comedic and dramatic.
Yeah.
And so to us, we needed an actor, embodied that.
An actor.
An actor, yeah. And so pretty quickly, Jean's name was at the top of the list because she's so skilled at doing both sides of that. And sent her the script and had fingers crossed for a few days. And then we got the word that she wanted to meet about it.
Oh, great. Yeah. And Hannah, where'd she come from?
So
they're both so good. They're so funny. Together. Everyone's good. Paul's good. And,
everyone. Our cast is, we're very lucky. Basically, it was the opposite of the Gene. You know, Gene, it was like, okay, let's get Gene Smart. Thank God we did. The search for Ava was a very exhaustive. I think I looked one time of all the self-tapes we'd received because it was during COVID. So everybody was just taping at home. Or maybe it was right at the beginning of COVID. So some people were auditioning in person. But I looked at the packet of all the actors and comedians who had auditioned for Ava. And I think I counted and it was like 450
oh my God.
Tapes we'd seen. And Hannah was just, you know, she was doing stand-up. And she, you know, came into the casting director's office and she did a self-tape and Paul Lucci and I are sitting watching, you know, every day we would get 20 tapes that we had to watch and she really stuck out to us. And then kind of continued to, in the process, you know, she comes in for a callback. Yeah. We say, oh, wow, there's really something here. And and that was kind of how it happened. Yeah.
Huh.
And then once, you know, once they do their chemistry tests, Gene and Hannah, that was kind of like, game over. It was they had such good instant chemistry.
Oh yeah?
Yeah, it was really
That's
cool.
great.
It was really cool.
And who's the woman that plays Paul's assistant?
Meg Stalter.
What's her trick?
So she kind of became known doing Instagram videos, front-facing camera videos. Uh-huh. Are you familiar?
No.
Okay.
What does that mean?
I mean, it just means like you're holding your phone up and you're, you know, turning the camera and then you're just like doing your bit straight to camera
sure.
that way.
Yeah. Yeah, I do
and
that.
And she was crazy funny on those and we knew of her through that. And then she does stand up. You know, she's an incredible performer too. And Paul was booked on a show with her and just was like, yeah, Meg is so funny. We have to we have to write this for her.
Oh, good. And that dude who plays Deborah's assistant? The actor?
Carl Clemens Hopkins, actor, yeah.
He's very good.
Yeah, they're theater.
Theater.
Yeah. And then Mark Indelicato plays Deborah's assistant, Damien. He was a child actor, was on Ugly Betty. So someone who's been in the business for a very long time. You know, casting's one of those things, like, it's just weird chemistry. Like, it's putting these people together. Yeah. And so we feel very lucky.
And you got an Emmy for the script?
Yeah.
The three of you?
Yeah.
That's great.
Thanks.
It's exciting, right?
It was very exciting. It was very cool. And not, honestly, not, even though we were nominated, not expected that we would win.
Yeah. And this season I thought was good. I thought it held together. I didn't know, like, I was skeptical coming out of the second season to see her in comedy clubs because I wonder how that went.
Mm-hmm.
But I think what's established that the reason it works is that she did have an audience.
Yeah. Yeah.
You know, at some point.
Yes. Yeah.
And in Vegas.
Yeah.
Yeah.
And still so, does have a niche audience.
That's right.
Yes.
So that was like what really kind of put it over. You know, that made it work.
Yeah.
So wait. So now what? Now are you guys waiting for a pickup or you got one?
We are waiting to officially hear. Yeah.
Looking good though, right?
I think so. Yeah.
All right. Well, I like it and it was great talking to you.
Very lovely talking to you. Thanks for having me.
There you go. That was a good talk. I enjoyed it. I liked it. Season 2 of Hacks just finished up. You can watch both seasons on HBO Max. And now I enjoyed this piece of guitar work I just did. I'm going to do for you now. Forever lives Monkey and LaFonda, cat angels everywhere. Hey folks, this episode is brought to you by Kleenex Ultra Soft Tissues, your ally to help tackle your allergy symptoms this season. I love the change of seasons, but nobody loves pollen and all those other things floating in the air that make you sneeze during this nice weather. Kleenex Ultra Soft Tissues are hypoallergenic and allergist approved. So fight back against watery eyes and runny noses without worrying about irritating your skin. You know all those times you've heard guests sneeze on the show? Well, actually, you don't hear any of that because we cut the sneezes out when we're editing. But take my word for it, people definitely sneeze in here, and when they do, I've got a box of Kleenex on the table right in front of them so they can use one and get right back to business. And here's what Kleenex means to me: a tissue that will hold up. We've all used those other tissues that you blow holes right through. When I see Kleenex, I know that tissue is up for the job. For this allergy season, grab Kleenex and face allergies head on.